Representatives from South Africa were in The Hague in Netherlands last week, making opening arguments before the United Nations International Court of Justice, arguing that Israel has committed, quote, genocidal conduct, end quote, against Palestinians in Gaza, that the latest war follows what South Africa alleges is a pattern of violence going back to 1967. Here's Adila Hassim, a lawyer for South Africa, speaking last week.
For the past 96 days, Israel has subjected Gaza to what has been described as one of the heaviest conventional bombing campaigns in the history of modern warfare. Palestinians in Gaza are being killed by Israeli weaponry and bombs from air, land, and sea. They are also at immediate risk of death by starvation, dehydration, and disease as a result of the ongoing siege by Israel, the destruction of Palestinian towns, the insufficient aid being allowed through to the Palestinian population, and the impossibility of distributing this limited aid while bombs fall. This conduct renders essentials to life unobtainable.
Israel's government has denied the claim of genocide, arguing that they're in the midst of a military response to the Hamas attacks in Israel in October. We're going to talk about what genocide means, both in a legal sense and in the public understanding of the concept, and how the international legal system functions in claims of genocide. We'll also take a look at South Africa's arguments, Israel's response, and what happens next in that case. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about genocide, how it fits into international law, how that law, whether that law is enforced? What do you want to know about how the International Court of Justice and how it operates, what jurisdiction or enforcement power it has? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Damir Kovacevic is an assistant professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire, where he teaches on topics including international conflict and political violence, and his research interests include genocide studies. Damir, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Rob.
How is genocide defined under international law?
So genocide under international law is a very specific, precise legal definition, and the definition that the ICJ is using in this case that you just mentioned and the one that the United Nations would be looking at and other international courts is the intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group. And there's, I think, three elements that are worth pointing out when kind of distinguishing genocide from other forms of political violence and other international crimes. That first one is probably the most important. That's the intent. Which is different from motivations or merely actions, right? Proving that the perpetrator actually had the intent to destroy this specific group. The other two would be group selectivity, which we just mentioned related to those four groups, and then group destructiveness, which it doesn't have to include the whole group, but a substantial portion of that group.
What do you think people misunderstand or get wrong about genocide when we talk about it kind of in the popular press?
Yeah, it's a question that, you know, I get a lot, and it's a question that, you know, in my own classes, we have to kind of grapple with and we debate. And even in the social science literature, the definition that the courts have established is narrow, I think, and that's precisely what they wanted, because they're looking into this from a legal standpoint, and it's a very serious allegation, right? So it's a serious crime. So proving intent can be very difficult, and that was the point. When we look at it from kind of a popular standpoint, or we just kind of the eye test itself, what we're looking at and what we're saying is, well, we're seeing mass killing. And mass killing, of course, is also a very serious, grave concern, as are things like war crimes and crimes against humanity and, of course, ethnic cleansing. But they don't necessarily carry that intent to destroy. And I think that's where we sort of distinguish genocide, at least from a legal standpoint. Now, in the social science literature and in my own literature sometimes, we might use various other definitions that still allude to genocide, but aren't kind of restricted by that intent and that legal sense.
And we didn't hear the whole case made by South Africa. The portion we heard, there are portions that address that intent. The portion we heard, somebody might hear that and say those might be war crimes against civilians that might not rise to the level of something we would call genocide. Is that a possible argument to make?
that's a possible argument. And if, for instance, the court does, you know, rule on that and says, okay, it might not be genocide, but we may, you know, we may determine that war crimes have been committed. Well, if they're making that claim, what they're looking at is then essentially three factors. They're looking at, does Israel have the military necessity, does Israel have the military necessity to respond? Is it responding in a proportional manner? And are they distinguishing between civilians and combatants? Many will claim that, of course, there is a military necessity because this is a right to self-defense going back to the October 7th attack. But I think where people are having issues with that is the proportional response, which many have said has been disproportionate. And of course, being able to distinguish between civilians and combatants, as we've seen the civilian death toll rise to about 24,000 with the most recent projections.
I want to talk about the concept of proportional response. As I understand it, and I may be completely wrong, Damir, that doesn't mean you look at the number of people killed on each side or the proportion of population on each side, but is the military effort by Israel targeting Hamas's military capacity proportionate with the damage it's doing to the need to do it, that military necessity you mentioned?
Yeah, absolutely. So it the right to self-defense is also, you know, rooted in international law, protected in international law, that doesn't give an actor, in this case Israel, the right to sort of say, okay, well, because we were attacked first, we have the right now to respond in any way that we want. That response must be proportional with, and again, that there isn't a specific threshold there, but, you know, proportional in terms of what happened on October 7th, what is a proportional response to that? And then, of course, attached to that, as I just mentioned earlier, is that distinction. In matters of war, you're never going to be able to completely eliminate civilian lives. And I think that international law covers that as well. But are you making a deliberate effort to distinguish between, a military target, which is, you know, covered under international law, which was considered a necessity, which was considered proportional, and then, of course, civilian combatants, which we consider out of bounds, sort of not covered by international humanitarian laws or the laws of armed conflict.
Damir Kovacevic is with us, political scientist at UW-Eau Claire, looking at genocide as it is reflected in international law, the nation of South Africa challenging Israel in a court, the International Court of Justice. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Damir, looking at the court now, we've got this International Court of Justice. What is it? What is its role?
So the International Court of Justice is one of the main bodies of the United Nations. So if anyone's familiar with the United Nations, they have probably heard of things like the General Assembly, right? The Parliament of Nations. They've heard of the Security Council, the P5, which the United States and Russia and China have a seat on, and France and the United Kingdom. The International Court of Justice hears disputes between states specifically, right? And that's what they're doing in this case. And in a previous case back in 2019, they did rule that an outside party, in this case South Africa, can bring these kinds of charges before the court, because if both parties are signatories of the Genocide Convention, in which case Israel and South Africa both are, it has the right to do that. And so it hears these disputes between states. And I say that to distinguish it from another court which has a similar name but has a different kind of role, and that's the International Criminal Court, the ICC, which also operates in The Hague, which, you know, in the Netherlands. That court specifically deals with individuals related to war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. So the ICJ in this case is hearing this specifically as state disputes. It doesn't normally hear these kinds of cases. It usually deals with cases of like border disputes or resources. But it is a court that, for instance, this kind of topic can be brought to it.
Suppose the court rules that one state, South Africa in this case, brings this charge against another, Israel. Suppose this court did end up ruling hypothetically that, yes, this is genocide. What then? Do they have any kind of enforcement powers?
Well, the decision is legally binding. I mean, if for those of us that study international politics, I mean, international law is a thing. But what I remind people is international law is very different from domestic law because of this question of enforceability and accountability, right? Ultimately, the question is, well, could Israel ignore this ruling? Absolutely. Have we seen this in the past? Yes, we have. usually from powerful states who may not necessarily agree with the decision. In this case, Israel has called it meritless. We've heard the United States refer to it as that. So they could simply just say, you know, we don't agree with it and we're going to continue on. Now, from a legal standpoint, you could say, okay, it doesn't have much effect that in that sense. But from the sort of public court of public opinion and sort of the diplomatic pressure, it could send a very symbolic message. And it could, of course, affect how others view Israel. It could affect, its role continuing on. But another thing that I would point out is that any kind of decision here will probably take months, if not likely years. So we're not going to probably hear anything anytime soon.
We're talking about the legal meaning of genocide, and at the case South Africa brought to the United Nations International Court of Justice last week, alleging that Israel has been committing genocidal conduct in Gaza during their military response to the Hamas attacks in October in Israel. Damir Kovacevic stays with us, assistant professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? How do you think the international community should handle claims, accusations of genocide? Do you have thoughts on what you want to see, if anything, come out of this court on these charges filed against Israel? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Damir Kovacevic, assistant professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire, talking about what constitutes genocide in the legal sense, the case that South Africa has brought before the UN's International Court of Justice, alleging that Israel has been committing genocidal conduct in Gaza. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jack is with us in Milwaukee. Jack, hi.
Hello. Yeah, the question I got is sort of a historical one here because I think there's maybe a wider problem. South Africa brought this case, but if you go all the way back to World War II, as I understand it, when the Russians and the Germans essentially eliminated Poland as an existing state. I believe the Nazis took the position they could do anything they wanted on that land because it didn't exist as a nation state. And that probably affects an awful lot of other conflicts in the world where you don't have some third-party signatory to a genocide treaty just sitting on their hands and doing nothing.
Jack, thanks for the call. Damir, the idea that, okay, if someone is not a state, doesn't have a functioning government that they can point to, does that make it difficult for them to have standing in the international legal system?
That's a great question. I think one of the things that courts have ruled on in the past in relation to genocide is that even in cases where you might not be a signatory, let's say, to the Genocide Convention, with many states are, generally customary international law still prohibits, you know, incitement of genocide or committing acts of genocide. And of course, the Palestinian people, although they are not viewed as a state by, you know, the entire international community, right? There's debate over what countries which countries acknowledge Palestinian statehoods, which don't. The Palestinian people, of course, are recognized as a group and protected under that definition. Now, of course, that definition has issues. There are some that say the definition is kind of narrow because it only protects those four specific groups. But in this case, what we're referring to would, of course, capture, the civilians living in Gaza.
Thanks for the call, Jack. And bringing up World War II, Damir, how much of our current system of international law, especially when it comes to genocide, has its origins in World War II and what I think everyone agrees on is the attempted genocide of Jewish people in Europe?
Yeah, so the term does originate, you know, the term genocide, right, as coined by a Polish lawyer, Raphael Lemkin, in 1944. Largely in response to what was happening during the Holocaust, but also, you know, in response to, let's say, the Armenian genocide or genocides that preceded that as well. The concept itself didn't have, let's say, legal standing, for instance, at the Nuremberg trials when they were overseeing and sort of when they convicted German perpetrators at that time of crimes against humanity and war crimes. In that time, genocide itself was a descriptive term. Now, post 1948, with the Genocide Convention and sort of the emergence of the United Nations, it not only now carries a kind of a descriptive term, a definition that we all understand it, and now has kind of legal standing. And from then on, it has been kind of adopted by other statutes. So if you think of the 1998 Rome Statute, which essentially establishes the International Criminal Court, genocide's also covered in that respect. And so that court can hear cases brought before it, and it has since 2002.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Ben is with us now in Watertown. Ben, hi, what did you want to bring up?
Hi, I was just wondering, we're talking genocide, and, well, first of all, it seems like the amount of women and children that they're reporting killed is a little bit off. Those are numbers given by Hamas, so I'm actually wondering how accurate that is. And because the Gaza population has been so supportive of Hamas and their actions, is there like a little, more acceptable, I guess, civilian casualty rate than there would be normally, because these people are, I don't want to say getting what they asked for or anything. I know they're living under an oppressive regime, but they're allowing, 30,000 Hamas rebels to, dictate what, the Gaza Strip, which has what, a population of how many million, they haven't, kicked them out, and they're the leading party. I was just wondering, I guess how that relates in order to genocide, because...
Ben, I think I take your point. This concept of, okay, can civilians in a society be held accountable for the actions of their leaders? I've seen the argument go the other way from Palestinian terrorist groups over the years, saying that all Israeli citizens are accountable for the and therefore viable targets because of the actions of their government. How does that hold up in international law, Damir?
A good question. And, we see, regardless of, let's say, the political support that civilians may have for a certain regime or for a certain group, I think, again, it comes back to that element of, international humanitarian law, which is civilians are not legitimate targets when it comes to military operations, even legitimate military operations. Of course, nobody is a legitimate target when it comes to genocide. So again, we go back to the question of necessity, proportionality, and distinction, regardless of what people's sort of political opinions may be or support or lack thereof for Hamas.
Thanks for the call, Ben. Damir, getting back to the idea of intent now when it comes to this South African case against Israel, there have been some people in the Israeli government using phrases like, we should drop an atomic bomb or a second, basically, catastrophe for the Palestinian people. And then the war cabinet saying, you're out of the war cabinet. They're not speaking for us. This is an operation targeting Hamas. Is that an important distinction as we're talking about genocide? If the war cabinet in Israel is saying this is a Hamas-targeted operation not intended for genocidal means?
It is important, and that's, the case that Israel made before the court. And, of course, those comments that we've heard, and we've heard other comments, from Netanyahu, that people said, are those comments sort of getting close to the sort of the borderline of genocidal intent or genocidal acts? Of course, they're comments that we don't want to hear, that we don't want to see. And so making that distinction, making that separation is, of course, important, because response to what happened October 7th against Hamas is legitimate and something that I think everyone can kind of support. Making that distinction that this is a war against Hamas and not a war against the Palestinian people is something that Israel has to do and has to do clearly.
I've seen the argument out there, Damir, that Hamas at various stages in its existence has had genocidal aims targeting the people of Israel, basically in its constitution. Could a non-state actor, a political party controlling a state in this case, be charged with genocide itself?
They could. Again, what that would mean is very difficult to predict. I mean, the ICJ last year or the year before that also ruled and said that Russia must cease its military operations in Ukraine. And we're at year three now with that war. So those things can be heard. Those things can be brought up. It's a little bit more difficult. But again, it goes back to this idea of legal enforcement, which is always the case and always an issue with when it comes to international law.
What are you watching for in a case like this before the International Court of Justice? What are you watching for in the, you said it wasn't a fast process, the days and months to come?
I guess what I'm looking to see is what this preliminary order might be. They may rule on this kind of preliminary order and say Israel must stop or limit its onslaught. And we've already kind of seen rhetoric coming out of Israel saying that they're kind of phasing out some of those operations. And I think some of that pressure has come from the United States. But hearing the court say that might be a first step, because I don't anticipate any kind of ruling for years to come. But they might have kind of a preliminary order, which could, of course, have diplomatic repercussions for Israel.
And if there's a finding against Israel or any other country, for that matter, is the country as a whole then responsible, or are leaders in some way held individually responsible in the International Court of Justice?
That's something that they're going to have to figure out. That's a very complicated task. If this was brought before the ICC, they'd be bringing in specific individuals, right, and citing those specific individuals that they want prosecuted. In this case, it's a state against a state. And so if this ruling does come in favor of South Africa, then the decision will have to be made. Well, who in that state is actually responsible for that? And we've never seen such a decision before. So that will be interesting to see.
Damir, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Damir Kovacevic is an assistant professor of political science at UW Eau Claire. He studies, among other things, international conflict and genocide. We talked to him about the international community's approach to charges of genocide after South Africa accused Israel of committing genocidal acts in Gaza. They took that case to the International Court of Justice.